listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
As of press time Monday, the government shutdown in Washington, D.C. continued. Democrats making the rounds of the talk show circuit on Sunday seemed less than impressed with the offering from President Trump on Saturday. We bring you here the president's remarks in their entirety.
Just a short time ago, I had the honor of presiding over the swearing-in of five new great American citizens. It was a beautiful ceremony and a moving reminder of our nation's proud history of welcoming legal immigrants from all over the world into our national family. I told them that the beauty and majesty of citizenship is that it draws no distinctions of race or class or faith or gender or background. All Americans, whether first generation or 10th generation, are bound together in love and loyalty, friendship and affection. We are all equal. We are one team. And one people proudly saluting one great American flag. We believe in a safe and lawful system of immigration, one that upholds our laws, our traditions, and our most cherished values. Unfortunately, our immigration system has been badly broken for a very long time. Over the decades, many presidents and many lawmakers have come and gone, and no real progress has been made on immigration. We are now living with the consequences, and they are tragic, brought about by decades of political stalemate, partisan gridlock, and national neglect. There is a humanitarian and security crisis on our southern border that requires urgent action. Thousands of children are being exploited by ruthless coyotes and vicious cartels and gangs. One in three women is sexually assaulted on the dangerous journey north. In fact, many loving mothers give their young daughters birth control pills for the long journey up to the United States because they know they may be raped or sexually accosted or assaulted. Nearly 50 migrants a day are being referred for urgent medical care. Vast quantities of lethal narcotics are flooding through our border and into our communities, including meth, cocaine, heroin, and fentanyl. Drugs kill 78,000 Americans a year and cost our society in excess of $700 billion. Heroin alone kills 300 Americans a week, 90% of which comes across our southern border. We can stop heroin. Illegal immigration reduces wages and strains public services. The lack of border control provides a gateway, and a very wide and open gateway, for criminals and gang members to enter the United States, including the criminal aliens who murdered a brave California police officer only a day after Christmas. I've gotten to know and love angel moms, dads, and family who lost loved ones to people illegally in our country. I want this to end. It's got to end now. These are not talking points. These are the heartbreaking realities that are hurting innocent, precious human beings every single day on both sides of the border. As a candidate for president, I promised I would fix this crisis, and I intend to keep that promise one way or the other. Our immigration system should be the subject of pride, not a source of shame, as it is all over the world. Our immigration system should be the envy of the world, not a symbol of disunity and dysfunction. The good news is these problems can all be solved, but only if we have the political courage to do what is just and what is right. Both sides in Washington must simply come together, listen to each other, put down their armor, build trust, reach across the aisle, and find solutions. It is time to reclaim our future from the extreme voices who fear compromise and demand open borders, which means drugs pouring in, human trafficking, and a lot of crime. That is why I am here today to break the logjam and provide Congress with a path forward to end the government shutdown and solve the crisis on the southern border. If we are successful in this effort, we will then have the best chance in a very long time at real bipartisan immigration reform. And it won't stop here. It will keep going until we do it all. The proposal I will outline today is based on, first and foremost, on input from our border agents and Homeland Security professionals. And professionals they are. They know what they're doing. It is a compassionate response to the ongoing tragedy on our southern border. In recent weeks, we have met with large numbers of Democrat lawmakers to hear their ideas and suggestions. By incorporating the priorities of rank-and-file Democrats in our plan, we hope they will offer their enthusiastic support, and I think many will. This is a common-sense compromise both parties should embrace. The radical left can never control our borders. I will never let it happen. Walls are not immoral. In fact, they are the opposite of immoral because they will save many lives and stop drugs from pouring into our country. Our plan includes the following: $800 million in urgent humanitarian assistance, $805 million for drug detection technology to help secure our ports of entry. An additional 2,750 border agents and law enforcement professionals. 75 new immigration judge teams to reduce the court backlog of, believe it or not, almost 900,000 cases. However, the whole concept of having lengthy trials for anyone who sets one foot in our country unlawfully must be changed by Congress. It is unsustainable. It is ridiculous. Few places in the world would even consider such an impossible nightmare. Our plan includes critical measures to protect migrant children from exploitation and abuse. This includes a new system to allow Central American minors to apply for asylum in their home countries and reform to promote family reunification for unaccompanied children, thousands of whom wind up on our border doorstep. To physically secure our border, the plan includes $5.7 billion for a strategic deployment of physical barriers, or a wall. This is not a 2,000-mile concrete structure from sea to sea. These are steel barriers in high-priority locations. Much of the border is already protected by natural barriers such as mountains and water. We already have many miles of barrier, including 115 miles that we are currently building or under contract. It will be done quickly. Our request will add another 230 miles this year in the areas our border agents most urgently need. It will have an unbelievable impact. If we build a powerful and fully designed see-through steel barrier on our southern border, the crime rate and drug problem in our country would be quickly and greatly reduced. Some say it could be cut in half. Because these criminals, drug smugglers, gangs, and traffickers do not stop at our border. They permeate throughout our country, and they end up in some places where you'd least expect them. They go all over our country. A steel barrier will help us stop illegal immigration while safely directing commerce to our lawful ports of entry. Many of these security ideas have been proposed by Democrats themselves, and all of them have been supported by Democrats in the past, including a physical barrier wall or fence. Furthermore, in order to build the trust and goodwill necessary to begin real immigration reform, there are two more elements to my plan. Number one is 3 years of legislative relief for 700,000 DACA recipients brought here unlawfully by their parents at a young age many years ago. This extension will give them access to work permits, social security numbers, and protection from deportation, most importantly. Secondly, our proposal provides a 3-year extension of temporary protected status, or TPS. This means that 300,000 immigrants whose protected status is facing expiration will now have 3 more years of certainty so that Congress can work on a larger immigration deal, which everybody wants, Republicans and Democrats. And our farmers and vineyards won't be affected because lawful and regulated entry into our country will be easy and consistent. That is our plan. Border security, DACA, TPS, and many other things. Straightforward, fair, reasonable, and common sense with lots of compromise. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has pledged to bring this bill to a vote this week in the United States Senate. Our proposal is not intended to solve all of our immigration challenges. This plan solves the immediate crisis, and it is a horrible crisis. It is a humanitarian crisis like we rarely see in our country. And it provides humanitarian relief, delivers real border security, and immediately reopens our federal government. If we are successful in this effort, then we can start the border project of remaking our immigration system for the 21st century. Once the government is open and we have made a down payment on border security and immigration reform starts to happen, I plan to convene weekly bipartisan meetings at the White House so we can do a finished product, a great product, a product that we can all be proud of having to do with that elusive immigration problem. Whatever we do, I can promise you this. I will never forget that my first duty and ultimate loyalty is to you, the American people. Any reforms we make to our immigration system will be designed to improve your lives, make your community safer, and make our nation more prosperous and secure for generations to come. Thank you, and God bless America. Thank you.
Sunday marked 1 week since the arrest by the FBI of American journalist Marzia Hashemi. Hashemi resides in Iran and is a presenter for Press TV based in Tehran. She was in the U.S. visiting family and working on a Black Lives Matter documentary when she was arrested a week ago Sunday. Very little information has been made available, although there have been reports that she is not the subject of a criminal investigation, but rather being held as a material witness. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif offered these comments about her case.
She is a famous journalist. She's done nothing but journalism. And the arrest of Mrs. Hashemi is a very clear affront to freedom of expression, a political abuse of an innocent individual. And I believe the United States should release her immediately without further delay.
The Committee to Protect Journalists based in New York has also called for her release. We'll be following this case as it develops. The foreign ministers of Russia and Germany sat down and talked on Friday, discussing a number of issues of mutual concern. This was Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov opening a press conference held jointly with Germany's foreign minister Heiko Maas on Friday in Moscow.
First part of our very useful talks. These talks have been very constructive, filled with various topics of discussion. Despite the differences of opinion on some subject matters, our cooperation continues to go further across a number of tracks. We have confirmed our willingness to reinforce our cooperation, as I believe we both believe that amid all the difficulties and troubles in Europe and in the world, a constructive dialogue between Russia and Germany is of special importance and necessity. We positively assess the development of our trade and economic ties despite the sanctions regime started by Washington. Berlin is a very important trade partner of ours. Between January and October, the trade grew by 23%, comparing to what we had last year, 2017, amounting to $49.8 billion. We do appreciate the fact that Germany continues to support the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project. It sees it as a commercial initiative which is meant to help to diversify the supply chain and, in addition to that, to enhance the energy security of the European continent. We also appreciate the work we do as part of the Russian-German Year of Educational Cooperation. It will continue up to the year 2020. It is meant to build build up the cooperation between the academic and university circles. This kind of is very important in terms of building trust between the nations, preventing the people of our countries from being alienated to each other, as well as enhancing people-to-people ties. Discussing the international issues, we paid utmost attention to the situation around the U.S. withdrawal from the INF Treaty. It is clear that the derailment of that treaty will bring very negative consequences to the world and international stability. On the heels of the U.S. withdrawal from the treaty, we see that now the whole architecture of the arms control is being targeted, including the STAR Treaty and all the prospects of further nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament, as well as the very foundations of the non-proliferation regime treaty, is also in danger. We discussed it in great detail with my counterpart, and Russia has confirmed that despite the ultimatum set forward by the U.S. and the failure to achieve any progress during the consultations which took place in Geneva on the 15th of January, we are ready to continue to talk and present real facts, all that in order to preserve that unique dialogue which, to a large extent, ensures the strategic stability in the world. But do you understand the Europeans' concerns, the concerns of Europe, because, well, the international world sees a lot of diplomats who still remember the crisis which emerged as a result of the Pershing missiles placed in Europe in last century. Discuss Ukraine and the need to consistently develop and implement the Minsk agreements. There has been no progress on that track, as well as there has been no progress on the track of the Normandy Quartet, and I mean the summit of the quartet which took place in 2015 and 2016. In Paris and Berlin, there a number of agreements were reached on the security and political matters, but unfortunately, because of the Ukraine's position, these arrangements have not been fulfilled so far. We believe that our European colleagues have already turned their attention to the blatant violations by Ukraine of their international obligations, which are to ensure the freedoms and rights, religious and language rights of the minorities, as well as we turn the attention of our colleagues to the rise of nationalism and extremist sentiments in Ukraine. We are to discuss Syria later on, because on that track we've seen some certain progress, and I hope that the arrangements reached during the summit between Germany, France, Turkey and Russia in Istanbul a couple of months ago, and I mean first and foremost the need to start the work of the Constitutional Committee as soon as possible, will be fulfilled in the immediate future. We briefed our colleagues on the upcoming meetings. On Monday, we will be receiving the new Syrian envoy, Mr. Peterson, and with him, we will be holding discussions, and we are looking forward to hear from him about his plans as of how to arrange the work of the Constitutional Committee. He spent a couple of days in Damascus discussing this and many other issues with the Syrian leadership. Germany, this and next year, will be the presiding country in the UN Security Council, and we are looking forward to effective cooperation with Germany on that track. I'm sure that participation of Europe in the work of the Security Council will contribute to the enhancement of the efforts applied by everyone to make all the arrangements true. Thank you for your attention. I give the word to my counterpart. Thank you.
Ja, vielen Dank, lieber.
Thank you very much, dear Sergei. Thank you for hosting and welcoming me to Moscow. And we agree that The international community is facing challenges, serious challenges right now. And so an honest and tight dialogue is utterly important right now, with clear positions and clear cooperation proposals and clear stance on international issues that we took. Since my last visit in May 2018, we've achieved a lot more than in the previous years. The educational and science partnership, and also the dialogue, high-level dialogue on the security issues, and the security working group is working again. And we also discussed that to commemorate the siege of Leningrad, we are going to help a hospital for siege survivors in St. Petersburg, and that is going to be a new signal this month. We also discussed again the INF treaty, and this treaty for 30 years has been keeping Europe safe, and it's still a very important cornerstone of the security architecture in Europe. So we're really interested in keeping it going. It affects us in a major way. So we do everything we can to make sure that this treaty has a future. We think that Russia can save this treaty. It's no secret that we, just like other NATO states, think that there's a cruise missile that violates this treaty, and it has to be destroyed so that there is compliance with the treaty on the part of Russia. But communication is still going on, and we see that Russia is ready to continue this dialogue and to use this time to give all necessary information and contribute to the INF, to keep an INF treaty going. But this treaty is not enough. It is also important to talk about control over arms, to continue this dialogue and keep it on the international agenda. I support this initiative, and I know that it's an important topic, but the issue of the international arms control is an important issue, but it hasn't been paid enough attention to in the past. So I invited Mr. Lavrov to a conference in Berlin to discuss new arms. And I hope that it will be attended by many different players, and we will be able to discuss all these autonomous arms systems, the robotic weapons that have been developed in recent years. And there is just not enough international control over those weapons. And at this level, I hope that we will move forward in this area, and we will include this issue in the international architecture of arms control. We also discussed the situation in Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine are responsible for making sure that we move forward in the Normandy 4 format so that there is a real ceasefire, and also the situation in the Sea of Azov and what happened there. We were also concerned with that. We don't want new conflicts there. We want free navigation there, and we're happy that this is happening right now. The November crisis should not repeat itself. We don't want those situations happen again, so we need clarity going forward. And what's happening now, and the fact that there is freedom of navigation now, we need to keep it that way, and that needs to be a permanent situation in that region. As for Ukrainian military detained in Russia, we think that they should be set free. And we will continue to our talks on Syria, and there are a lot of issues and questions here. All the interested parties that can influence the Syrian regime, all these players should be responsible in their actions and work with other international players. We need to work with the new UN envoy, Peterson, who started in this new office in the beginning of the year. Also, the situation in Idlib, access of humanitarian organizations, and working with refugees who come back to Syria. We need to work there. And also, the constitutional process is an important area, and we discussed all those areas during our talks, and we know that it's obvious now that we can only achieve results if we continue the dialogue. So it's good that we're talking to each other today, and we will continue our talks. We agreed that we would keep talking in the next weeks, in the following weeks. Interfax, please. My question is for Mr. Lavrov. What do you think about the fact that Ukraine is not going to open any polling stations in Russia and also would not allow Russian observers as part of the OSCE monitoring mission in Ukraine? And also, what can you say about the prospects of the Normandy 4 format?
We have a negative attitude towards this, and what we see is that their decision not to open polling stations at diplomatic missions of Ukraine and Russia, nothing but the desire of Ukraine to artificially influence the voting outcomes in favor of the current government. This way, Ukraine is stripping millions of Ukrainians of the right to vote. I mean, Ukrainians who live and work in Russia, and that is a violation of all norms which are existent and which are supposed to be in place within the framework of the OSCE if we are talking about free and democratic elections, of course. Mr. Klimkin, Foreign Minister of Ukraine, explained it. The decision not to open polling stations at Ukrainian diplomatic missions by saying that there is no safety guarantees, well, that's beyond criticism. On a regular basis, we hold a lot of international events, the World Cup for one. Hundreds of thousands of people visited it, including many people from Ukraine, and there was not a single incident which could be said to jeopardize the security. We have received no complaints, no nothing. But it is a whole other thing to see when the elections take place in Russia. We open our polling stations everywhere, in Kiev, in our general consular missions. And it's not the first time when we see that the pravi sector, the right sector, activists and neo-Nazis surround our diplomatic missions and prevent people from coming and casting their votes.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Situated between Russia and China, Mongolia is the world's most landlocked country. And yet, according to my guest today, this isn't a strategic weakness, but rather a competitive advantage. How has Mongolia managed to overcome its geographical limitations? And can it use this experience to punch above its weight in the geopolitical ring? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Damdin Sogbatar, Mongolia's Minister of Foreign Affairs. Minister, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for the invitation.
Now, we are recording this interview on the sidelines of the Valdai Forum, and many of the discussions here today are about Ukraine and how it's being sandwiched between Russia and the West led to a conflict. Mongolia also finds itself between two great powers, Russia and China, and yet from what I understand, it is a source of development rather than discord. How do you explain that?
Well, we're developing a balanced relationship with our neighbors, and it's our priority. With Russia and China, we have strategic partnership. And really, it is a trust-based, confidence-based relationship. The most important thing is really the fact that you give priority to this relationship. You base your relationship on your strengths. Of course, we're different countries. That means we have differences. It doesn't mean that we do not have differences. But it's very important to manage those differences and to capitalize on your strengths.
But from what I understand, it took you some time to arrive at that perspective, because you said in one of the interviews that before Mongolia used to view its landlocked status as a limitation.
Yeah.
What allowed for that change of perspective and this new vision of being landlocked and having no access to the sea as something that you can actually gain from?
Yeah, you know, two things. Again, under the Law of the Sea Convention, we have the right to access the sea. And our neighbors, due to our very good neighborly relationship, which is of strategic nature, we're having no problem with our access. And that strength of international law, we should be also using fully, which means it is, you know, in dealing with our two very big neighbors, still, we're also using their goodwill plus international law as well. That's one thing. Secondly, these two markets themselves are very big markets. For example, China is one of prime, you know, export markets of Mongolian commodities. Russia is also a very big market, but yet we're buying more from Russia than selling. And that has, we're outlining it in our discussions with our Russian friends. We're telling them honestly our problems, that we don't like this deficit and this has to be changed.
But I assume you tell them that not in a way that, for example, the current administration of the United States tells its trade partners.
Well, what I really think is that we're using all our, instruments that are in our disposition, which means long-standing, friendly history of cooperation. And therefore, when we are communicating this sort of messages of ours, we really meet also understanding. On the other hand, our trade with our neighbors is beneficial to our neighbors as well. It creates jobs in the adjacent provinces and regions of our neighbors. So it's not that, it is not an unfair relationship. We're talking about mutually beneficial relationships.
You're being very positive, but in the Russian-Chinese relationship in public is all about smiles and handshakes, but behind closed doors, the two can be pretty tough negotiators. And I've heard many stories in Moscow of how inexorable the Chinese were when negotiating the price of gas with the Russians. I'm sure there are many other examples as well. Are you sure that either of them is not using or not trying to enlist your country as a leverage against the other?
Well, you should ask them,
but
not us.
You would know. You would be the first to know about that, I guess.
Yeah. What I really think is that it really is a trilateral relationship, which means it's not only about Moscow and Beijing, it's about us as well. And we're there. And our game is that to keep the balance. And it matters, because when we are saying that, look, here it's a little excessive, we're worried about it. The good thing is that we're telling, as strategic partners, there is an agreement to tell honestly the problems. So as you said, and as I said before, yes, I am positive, but I said we are different countries and therefore we have differences. Not everything is chocolate sweet.
Good to know. You said it's a trilateral relationship, a truly trilateral relationship, but wherever there is Russia and China, the United States is never too far away. What's your current state of affairs with Washington?
Very close, very close. And we just had visit of our prime minister to the United States, and Up until now, we had comprehensive partnership. And now we have extended the level of our cooperation to an extended comprehensive partnership. So we're already making one move ahead in terms of advancing our relationship. And that really means, you know, trade, technology, education, culture, you know, we are, you know, taking into our focus, and we are, you know, on our policy-based decisions, we deliberately are working to expand them.
Now, the arrival of the Trump administration into the White House has changed the American relationship with many countries, both foes and friends, to the worst. Are you saying that Mongolia is a rare exception to that?
Everybody heard the speech of President Trump at the General Assembly. And he said, he talked about principled pragmatism as the doctrine of the U.S. policy. And the U.S. is saying, well, we are requesting the countries of the world to respect their sovereignty. And in return, they will be respecting and working with them. They will not be trying to have other countries have certain types of, you know, systems. It's their business. So you see, in other words, this principled pragmatism is, you know, the way we also see the foreign policies of other countries as well. And therefore, you know, we're really trying to catch the moments that are, you know, positive, on which we can build the cooperation on a bilateral basis with our partners.
You're being very diplomatic, as I'm sure you have to be, but about a month ago, Mongolia, together with Russia and China, took part in the biggest military exercise to be held in Northeast Asia in more than three decades. And unlike other military drills, which usually focus on honing specific skills, the Vostok maneuvers were simulating a war scenario. Who could possibly threaten Mongolia with a ground war?
You know, it's not about threatening or about threat, but it's about, you know, if our neighbors...
But you talked about pragmatism. Yeah, I'm sure if you exactly. do something, you have a pragmatic reason for that.
Exactly. Therefore, we have our military. Doesn't matter how small it is, but a state has to have its own military. That's one thing. Secondly, if you have a military, they better be trained. And then they better be interoperable with their neighbors. Because, for example, due to our very long-standing relationship with Soviet Union then, and many of our military officers were trained in Russia, and then, you know, many of our officers were pretty comfortable that, we know, Russian maneuvers, tactics, etc. But with time, we started, you know, if you do not keep training,
absolutely,
you stay behind.
Minister, I'm sorry for interjecting, but my point that I made earlier was that it's not just any other military drill, which usually focus on improving, enhancing the coordination and cooperation. Those maneuvers had a very specific scenario, a scenario of a ground war, which tells me at least that your partners and your neighbors, Moscow and Beijing, believe that that scenario is probable. Do you share that vision?
You know, the military have their own way of thinking. And the military has to be ready for any kind of, you know, activities. Possible activities. It would be naive to think that, oh, it's very remote, it won't be happening. If you're in the business of building strategic thinking, you cannot afford to assume that something will not happen.
Now, Mongolia is very straightforward about wanting to grow all of the Russian-Chinese trade, but any benefit could be a liability, and both Moscow's and Beijing's relations with Washington are quite complicated right now. Are you fully insulated from the potential fallout from the bickering between both Russia and China on one side and the United States on another?
Of course, the risks are there. And therefore, we're really also trying to counterbalance this sort of risks. And therefore, we have third neighbor policy. And on the basis of that approach, we're building very strong ties with our third neighbors as well, so that in case of problems, we still have live, vibrant commercial relationship with other countries. So therefore, the risks are there. We really want this to stop. And we hope that at some stage, you know, the parties will come to terms. Even in the countries with the most close relationship, there are differences. But if you really start only building and attending those differences and then attending them with negative approaches, then at times you don't solve the problems, but you exacerbate them. The important thing is that no matter how difficult it is, to keep the dialogue.
Now, let me ask you specifically about the Trump administration's intense focus on China's trade policies. One could make a case that if China's exports to the United States are inhibited, it may encourage Beijing to expand other markets even more. Could Mongolia be actually a beneficiary of the Sino-American trade wars?
Let me be very diplomatic here. We do not want to benefit on the loss of any of our partners. So we really want to keep our way of life, to keep this relationship with everybody. So therefore, I really think that they find common language. But in terms of China's position, they were, I think, this discussion over the trade deficit, it was there already long before, even under Obama administration, and many administrations were talking about this trade deficit, right? So China was already anticipating that at some stage this could come up. And my interpretation of their response is that this Belt and Road idea was already put in place back in 2013. And this was already in anticipation. In case something happens, they wanted to have other markets where they would be also supplying their products.
Is that in case, or do you think they would develop that initiative regardless of their relationship with Washington?
Of course, they would have done it regardless of that. But still, I think they were aware of this sort of thing. That's one thing. Secondly, I mean, Central Asian economies, these frontier economies were coming out of crisis. They were new markets, and they provided new opportunities for their goods and services. So naturally, as you say, with or without these new problems, they would have been already dealing with it, but and opening up these new markets and ensuring access of their products and services.
Minister, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Damdin Sogbatar, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Mongolia. Minister, Mongolia is a rare example in Asia of a country that gets along with pretty much all its neighbors near and far. And I heard a number of American experts, for example, from the Brookings Institution, suggest that because of that, it may serve as Geneva or Helsinki of the East. Is that your intention?
We wouldn't mind, but we do not have this sort of established goal of becoming one. You know why? Because if you don't, you'll get the frustration. So you better not end in that sort of situation. What we have, you know, we're a Buddhist country. What we have is already pretty good enough for us. We do not really want to be this host of many things. But if the countries choose Mongolia, we really don't mind.
And yet, just the other day, Mongolia issued an invitation to Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, to visit your country whenever he finds suitable. And that coincides with the prospect of a second meeting between the North Korean leader, the American president, and apparently there is a search for the most convenient location for that. What do you think Ulaanbaatar can offer that Singapore wasn't able to provide?
Singapore is a great place and they could provide everything. So we're not in this sort of competition. We can provide something more, etc. No, Mongolia's objective is very simple. This world peace order, and especially the peace in our region, is the most fundamental capital we have so far. And we're benefiting from it. And we really do not want to be these free riders of this, you know, great value that we have. So we really want to contribute to the strengthening and consolidation of peace to the extent that we can. So therefore, as long as these peace talks are in place, no matter where it happens, it's already good enough for us.
With all due respect, I think you're being very modest, because I see Mongolia foreign policy as a little bit more proactive than you described. For example, back in 2013, your president, then president, was the first head of state to visit North Korea after Kim Jong-un took power, and you maintained a pretty good relationship with that country ever since. Can you give any advice, for example, to the Americans or other members of the international community of how to engage North Korea productively?
Our relationship with North Korea did not come about yesterday. You know, North Korea's history of this state is 70 years. We are one of very few countries that has 70 years of history of diplomatic relationship with them. When Pyongyang was being bombed to the ground, our ambassador, most of the ambassadors were leaving, and one of few ambassadors that stayed there, you know, to show the solidarity was a Mongolian ambassador. They never forget that. So during Korea War, there were many orphans, and although Mongolia is a small country, but with all our heart, we tried to help them. And we brought many Korean orphans to come and stay in Mongolian families. So already we have family relationships. So the relationships are very deep and very long-standing. And on the basis of this, we are really communicating with the North Koreans, and we're really trying to also bring across the idea that denuclearization is a much better option. Because, and in this, there is no double standard or hypocrisy. We are, you know, nuclear-free status country. So we're telling, well, that's what we are. And this policy is working for us. And we're trying to communicate, you know, this denuclearized, you know, situation may contribute much better to their security than the nuclear, you know, programs.
Well, the United States clearly is not approaching North Korea in the same fashion, with the same emphasis on humanitarian affairs. What is it about the American approach to North Korea that you think is not working?
I think so far the approach was working.
Was working.
Yes.
You mean the Trump approach of threatening first and then pulling back? Is that a good
these are also
way to
diplomatic,
address it?
Yeah, these are also diplomatic, you know, tactics. Diplomatic negotiations are very long, you know, process. So, in fact, they were tried to approach from a different angle by the previous administrations. And on the basis of that experience, this administration knows that, okay, this approach is not quite working. Now let's try something else. And then they're approaching with this different approach. It was pretty daring approach, actually. And it really faced a lot of criticism in Washington as well. But yet, they dared to go ahead with that. And now we have these talks. I mean, all that North Korea, as far as I remember, and I've been in this policy for quite a long time, and the North Koreans were saying that we want to sit down with the Americans and talk. And this was not happening. Now it's happening. So it's a move ahead.
Now, North and South Korea have just agreed to begin reconnecting rail and road links, something that was met with concern in the United States. Americans are fearing that this may undermine the current sanctions regime. Do you see that as a kind of a bad cop, good cop routine, or do you think there are genuine disagreements between Seoul and Washington on how to approach North Korea?
A very important factor in the change of situation was this new policy of the South Korean administration. That thawing of relationship between South and North was a very strong impetus and basis for the U.S.-North talks. And therefore, I think both South Korea and the U.S. are in very close communication. And it's not secret. I mean, everybody knows this. And this, negotiation is being carried out in synchronized efforts. So I'm sure there are consultations going on.
Whenever North Korea is mentioned, the issue of human rights usually comes up, and I know that you served as the chairman of the Parliamentary Subcommittee on Human Rights. I assume this issue is near and dear to your heart. How do you think the international community should approach that subject when it talks to North Korea?
You know, human rights institution, I think, is one of the most fundamental achievements we as human beings achieve. And at any cost, against anybody, this should be protected. We have this human instinct, actually, of protecting each other. Therefore, when there is, problem with human rights, you need to talk about them.
But I'm sure you know that there is very deep skepticism, at least in this country, that Western countries may be instrumentalizing the issue of human rights too much, exaggerating it when it is politically expedient, ignoring it when it's politically inconvenient. Do you think the current international discourse on human rights is genuine and productive in terms of actually addressing the subject?
I believe it's genuine. I believe it's genuine. But of course, we're not in heaven. We're on planet Earth, and this place is not perfect. So I do not rule out there are certain problems, right? But in general, just go around and ask, who does not agree with the supremacy of human rights? Everybody would agree. Which country does not protect its own citizens? All the countries, including the country we were just talking about, they would be claiming that we're protecting our citizens. This fundamental interest in protecting human rights is pretty genuine. But when it comes to the real implementation, there could be problems. And whenever these problems are, we should be one by one settling them. But we should not be really trying to make it perfect right away. That will cause a lot of mess.
So Mongolia had its own transformation from a socialist state to a capitalist state. Looking at North Korea, what do you think presents a greater danger to the region and to the world as a whole, preserving the North Korean system in a state that exists right now with its nuclear weapons, with its pretty repressive government, or perhaps the efforts to change it? What's a bigger danger, bigger risk?
The bigger risk is the continuation of nuclear policies and preserving nuclear weapons or an attempt to keep it going on, that would be much bigger risk. The rest, as long as the region is peaceful, then, the rest will be happening as a result of interaction. Still, under the international law, under the UN Charter, the principles of sovereignty, independence are the fundamental, norms of international law. But through interaction, I think there will be certain reforms and changes. And especially now, Chairman Kim Jong-un is talking about focusing more on the economy. And they already made their party decisions to focus more on the economy. Focusing more on the economy, from our own experience, from the experience of Russia, Mongolia. We all lived in socialist society. If you want to change your economy, there will be reforms and changes. It will be just necessary.
Well, Minister, I have to thank you for you being very generous with your time, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.